Two of the papers this afternoon represent efforts that have been going on for about 3 years. And because of the reticence of many companies to put their own money into a speculative area, it's not surprising that these systems came into being directly through military sponsorship. And these are two Air Force programs that I'm sure you've heard and read about over the last 3 years in the doing, that have now come close enough to completion that we can begin to question their authors as to just how successful they have been, and I will leave it up to them to tell you. The third paper is also an Air Force-sponsored program of somewhat more recent vintage and less close to completion, and Joe Campo of Lytton will be talking to you about that. And the fourth paper, which actually will be the lead-off paper, represents one of the few cases where an industrial concern committed itself fully to complete system redesign based on LSI, again, at an early enough date, 3 years ago or so, to hope to accomplish this kind of a conversion by this point in time. Characteristic of many of these programs is some type of design automation, and the first speaker will tend to cover this area, and the kind of work that he has done is rather typical of that which is being required in applying large-scale integration. And I think you'll find it interesting from that standpoint. We're going to present all four papers, one right after the other, without any questions, so I would ask you to jot down your questions as they occur to you, because after the four papers have been presented, we're going to ask the speakers to come up here and sit down and see if we can't get a viable panel discussion on some of the questions that I'm sure you will have at that point in time. So don't leave after the last paper. Give us a chance to communicate with you. The first paper is Operational Computer-Aided Systems and MOS LSI Design Procedures by Jack Field of National Cash Register in Dayton, Ohio. Jack was a native of Chicago, Illinois. In fact, got his BS at IIT. And then went west. He got his MS at USC and spent about 8 years working for Hughes and later Northrop out on the West Coast. He's been back in the Midwest now for 3 years with NCR, where he is head of the Electrical Design Services Engineering Department. Jack?
Thank you, Dr. Thornton. First slide, please. In this presentation, I will describe an operational computer-aided system and MOS LSI design procedure. And this procedure has been developed to ensure the error-free and timely introduction of the next generation of digital equipment. MOS LSI has the potential of greatly reducing equipment size and lowering circuit and packaging costs. It will also greatly reduce power consumption with attendant savings and associated power supplies. Next slide, please. MOS LSI will have initial application in small, low-speed data processing equipment, such as adding machines and calculators, cash registers, accounting machines, terminals, small computers, and similar equipment. This shows an artist's conception of a terminal with message display, keyboard, and card reader. This might be linked by telephone to a remote data processor. Here is a possible data capturing device with keyboard and telephone data link. This type of equipment will become, or rather remain, prohibitively expensive for commercial use until LSI becomes economically manufacturable in volume. Now, our standard array packages are, you see on the left, the 16-pin dual inline. On the right, the 24-pin dual inline, and on the center, the square 40-pin pack. Other smaller standard packages will be used for functions such as shift registers, which require a fewer number of pins. Now, the practical utilization of LSI is beset with many problems. And the first of these is, of course, the intricate and error-prone nature of the design procedures which have been historically used. And these include manual circuit and array design, composite layout, Ruby with cutting, manual error detection, and primitive test methods. And these resulted in long development cycle for the equipment, extremely large development expense, design changes being very time-consuming and costly, and pointed out a need for a new equipment manufacturer semiconductor supplier relationship. Now, the solution to all this, we feel, is the development of a computer-aided total design system for the application of these arrays to any digital system to obtain, first of all, minimum system design errors, secondly, minimal LSI array development cost, and thirdly, minimum turnaround time. And the most important of these, however, is minimum system design errors. Now, the array development cycle that we see is for the logic designer to manually develop and partition his logic. Then by using this man-machine procedure, computer-aided design procedure, he produces, or the system produces, 101 artworks, test tapes and printouts of the logic and of the test patterns for testing the array. And this documentation package is sent to our vendor for fabricating and testing a sample quantity of these arrays. They are then sent to the equipment manufacturer for his evaluation of these arrays on his automatic tester. And if they pass this inspection, they go into the system and the system will be tested. And of course, if the system works, we're ready for a field trial. If it doesn't work, of course, we have to go back and redo any number of things. The production cycle we see is simply to write a purchase order. The vendor will already have the tapes and artworks. He fabricates and tests the arrays. He sends them to the equipment manufacturer for incoming inspection and test. Then they go to our manufacturing division for system fabrication and then on to the system test and shipment to a customer. Now, our entire computer-aided design procedure depends upon the existence of a family of standard building blocks. These standard cells are designed manually, and this results in a cell drawing. And these designs are analyzed with the aid of a computer. The cell drawing is digitized, and a deck of cards is punched, and the data is stored in the computer memory. Now, the validity of these cell designs must then be verified by fabrication in silicon. And for this purpose, a number of standard cell test arrays were developed. Plot on the Gerber, artwork generated and test tapes, and the vendor fabricated a sample of these standard cell test arrays. And remember, the sole purpose in life for these is to prove the validity of these circuit designs. Then the vendor sent these to NCR. We tested these and performed an engineering evaluation to examine the circuit performance and all expected worst-case combinations of operation. Here's an example of an output driver, which is what would be a typical standard cell. Notice the interdigitated fingers on the P regions, contact holes, thin oxide areas, and of course the pad. This shows the cell being digitized on the corner digitizer. Next slide, please. And this shows the cell data being entered into the computer memory. Now, this block diagram shows the operations performed in our MOS array design system. Inputs to the system are partition logic equations of the Boolean form and what we call a bubble layout. This bubble layout is a topological representation of the logic mechanized on the array in an abbreviated format. Now, this bubble layout is digitized, and the computer then does the following things. Four-phase mechanization. It compiles the array, which really means adding all of the data necessary to describe this array completely topologically in terms of standard cell placement. And it also performs a circuit and logic analysis. And test data is generated by a man-machine iterative procedure. Now, a hardware mock-up is required in those cases. That's awfully vague. Could you sharpen up the picture, please? An array mock-up is required for those cases where logic must interface with mechanisms. We currently know of no way to simulate this interface with a computer. It's important that this mock-up, which is really used to test the correctness of the logic and the interface to the mechanism, it's important that this mock-up bear an exact one-to-one correspondence with the array that's going to result later on. Otherwise, we can do an awful lot of useless redesign and a checkout. Now, having done this, having proven that this data is correct, we go into mass data generation programs, which convert the topological information obtained from the array compiler into a sequence of operations to be performed by the Gerber. And this sequence is optimized for plotting time and accuracy. Then the artwork is plotted at 101, and we're ready to go to our vendor. Here's an example of a mock-up board and the associated standard daughter boards. Logic is implemented on these motherboards by suitably interconnecting the daughter boards by wire wrapping the reverse side of the motherboard. You can see the pins, a few of them right here and here. Now, this is a set of colored overlays, which are colored copies of the artwork sent to our vendor for fabrication. Notice the standard cell output drivers, clock generator, and then on the central logic portion where the logic is implemented, the standard cells, which are much, much tinier. Now, the equipment development cycle must be carefully analyzed to ensure that the arrays will cause the resulting product to work properly. Unit and system specifications must be properly defined. System and logic design must be performed correctly. The arrays must be designed and the arrays fabricated by the semiconductor supplier. The equipment must be fabricated and tested. And if all goes well, the system is now ready for a field trial. However, mistakes will be made, changes will be necessary, and of course these may come about at any point. And if too many errors are made, we never get out of the design loop. Now, errors are more difficult to correct at each successive stage of the design. And to detect and correct errors at the earliest possible point, simulation is performed at every stage. And the corrections implemented at that point and not allow errors to permeate down this chain. The result, then, will be a set of error-free partition logic equations for array design. Now, in the array design, the bubble layout is sketched, worksheets are made out, and a deck of cards is punched and inputted to the computer, which detects input errors on the cards and compiles the array. Circuit and logic performance is evaluated, and at that point, then, after the array is laid out in the computer, we have error detection features which will detect design errors, and a composite will be printed. Now, if layout changes are needed and no logic changes, we go back up and start over again at this point. Or we can start, like, at this point if there's a mistake in a card. If logic changes are needed, we have to go all the way back out of this loop redesign the logic and possibly repartition and generate new test data. So you see how extremely essential it is that all of these steps be done sequentially correctly. Now, if there are no layout changes needed, we simply make the artwork and plot. Here's a bubble layout being digitized using a standard worksheet. Next slide, please. And this is an actual bubble layout for an array made as part of our evaluation array program. Now, we have emphasized the area shown in red to take you through the design of this portion of the chip as a typical example. Now, the area on the array, which I've just shown in red, is shown here in its Boolean equation form. This equation, incidentally, would require 9 gates if mechanized with NAND-type integrated circuits. Now, in addition to the Boolean equation just shown, the L data, which you see here, specifies the XY coordinate of the starting location of the stage. Now, the Y data, which you see here, specifies the coordinate, really, of the Y coordinate of the output metal line. All the remaining data shown on this page was calculated by the computer in terms of X and Y positionings of various types of standard cells. Now, a composite representation of the array as shown here is printed by the computer as a feedback to the logic designer, as well as error messages to aid the designer in debugging the array design. And the stage we've been following is again outlined in red, as well as the associated output driver and interconnections, the data for which must also be entered as input data in standard cell form. Now, each symbol on this composite has a special significance. For example, a plus, which you can't see very well at all, shows the areas of p-diffusion, and a zero, which would normally be along here, would indicate a metal run and so forth. Next slide, please. Now, the artwork, after it has passed all of these inspections, is then fabricated on the Gerber you see here. And the actual 100:1 artworks results from this process. Now, this green colored overlay is a contact print of the artwork for a p-diffusion mask. The boron p-diffusion is used to fabricate the source and drain of transistors, as well as the basically vertical interstage interconnections. And the interconnections you see are like here. Here, for example, would be the drain and source of a typical transistor. And then we have, of course, much larger interdigitated output devices and a clock generator and so forth. Now, the red mask, which is superimposed, delineates areas of thin oxide for gates and contact holes. And you see them, for example, here and here and here. Now, the blue, which is now superimposed on the other two, and you can't see that very well, but every one of these areas that are dead-ended, there will be a contact hole placed. Now, the blue mask, then, is used for delineating areas where we want contact holes to be etched. Now, the orange artwork, which is now superimposed on the others, delineates areas of metallization for gates. And here would be, for example, gates of some typical logic transistors. Primarily horizontal interconnections, pads, and metal to P interconnections through contact holes. And the fifth mask, which is in black here, is for the purpose of removing from the pad areas the layer of glass which is placed over the metallization in order to protect the chip during scribing, breaking, and otherwise handling in the assembly process. Now, here we show a collection of arrays which were successfully designed by NCR and fabricated by our semiconductor supplier doing our development program. Now, the arrays are tested on this computer-controlled tester. This tester can be used in wafer probe, finished package test, and can also be used for testing these hardware mock-up boards, which I described. This tester can be used to perform many functions needed to weed out weak units at probe test, as well as providing a capability for a thorough engineering evaluation of the arrays. A girl is sitting here at the computer console. Here is the tester mainframe, which is basically a very large MOS memory. There is interfacing circuits to the 310 in there, and as well as interfacing circuits and timing circuits to the cable, which you see here leading to the array testing box. Now, this array adapter box contains comparator electronics as well as output drivers that go to the through the cable to the tester mainframe. Here is an array being tested, and here are some additional arrays waiting for test to be performed. Now, in conclusion, we feel that MOS-LSI offers a tremendous potential of increasing the performance-cost ratio of digital equipment. In order to realize this potential, we have developed a computer-aided total design system. Now, this total design system has been used successfully in developing numerous large-scale integrated circuit arrays. It has also been used to perform much of the work which I have mentioned regarding system and logic simulation. Now, this type of equipment will become both a technical and an economic reality. There's a big job remaining ahead of us to achieve these goals, and it will take a coordinated effort between the systems manufacturer and the semiconductor supplier. Our success in this development program, however, gives us confidence that this coordinated effort, spirit of cooperation between the equipment manufacturer and the semiconductor supplier, and our mutually complementary technical capabilities will carry us to joint success in the marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. I'm sure you can think of a lot of tough questions to put to Jack later on with regard to that presentation. Very good. The second paper is Array Processing and Large-Scale Integration, given by Joe Campo of Litton Systems in Woodland Hills, California. Joe is a native of Cleveland, Ohio. Obtained his B.S. at Case Institute and his M.S. at UCLA. And since that time has worked on the West Coast, first at Hughes and later on at Litton, where he is presently a member of the technical staff. Joe?
We at Litton have been working on in large-scale integration for the last 4 years, approximately. We have several digital computers under development at this time. And we've encountered the problems that the previous speaker has discussed so completely and effectively. Our approach to the problem, I would say, is along the same general lines that National CAS has followed. The largest problem is the thing that you don't appreciate originally is the difficulty of making changes in the artwork, that is, the effect of mistakes. And those of you in the audience that aren't working close with large-scale integration, you can't appreciate it until you get into it. It's on a typical piece of digital equipment, as you know, if there's a mistake in the logic, you can change this very easily in terms of taking a resistor out and, or changing a wired connection and so forth. But with large-scale integration, it means going through a complete cycle in terms of changing the artwork, in terms of seeing to it that the detailed exposure masks are made properly. All along the way, you have mistakes not only of your digital system, but also of the artwork manufacturer, of the mask maker, and then finally having the wafers come back. And optimistically, this would be a six-week period, but in fact, it turns out to be perhaps a 2 months or even more. And of course, we aim at ways to shorten this time, because these redesign cycles are what take the time in the program. Of course, it also conditions you to make sure your work, to begin with, is as free from errors as possible. So with that introduction, I'd like to talk about the specific program we've had with the Air Force since January of 1967, developing a kind of computer called an array processor. Large-scale integration imposes certain constraints on its use. Many of you in the audience are intimately familiar with this, these constraints. But for the rest of you, it's the problem of trying to minimize the number of leads entering and leaving your devices. It's also the problem, which I'll get into in a moment, of trying to use devices which contain imperfections. May I have the first slide, please? This is a, just to give you an idea, again, it's for those of you in the audience who aren't completely familiar with what large-scale integration is. The object that's being held is a silicon wafer. It's made from a large cylindrical ingot. You slice a thin blank. In the most commonly used process in the industry today, the silicon blank is first coated with a resistive material, which is then exposed using the masks which have been referred to by the previous speaker. The exposure then admits light to certain regions on the resist, and after development process, these, because this is a very loose description of the process, because I can't go into any details. That would take the rest of the period. But that's the basic idea. In other words, the simultaneous development of thousands and thousands of transistors all at the same time. The basic process that's used in this industry today employs four masks. The first mask letting through the P regions, which, as the previous speaker stated, form parts of the transistors. And the P region can also be viewed as the, as it were, the one of the sides of a two-sided circuit board. If you can imagine a two-sided circuit board, the P region can be thought of as the bottom side. The fourth step in the process puts the metallization down. Again, thousands and thousands of metallization paths all at the same time. And this can be viewed as the other side of the metal of the etched circuit board, if I were carrying the analogy over. The second and third steps, crudely put, the second step forms the gate of the MOS transistor. The third step, again crudely put, forms the feed-throughs between the top and the bottom layer, or between the metal and the P. So this is a basically simple process. Other manufacturers have been experimenting with what might amount to multi-layer boards. That is, where you'd have more than just the two-sided board, where you'd have, and of course, multi-layer circuit boards have advantages in terms of minimizing the size. On the other hand, there are problems. You have extra problems in putting the extra metallization layers on. The 16,000 transistors there is a typical figure. That's a typical wafer. It's quite old. That picture was taken several years ago. We have a yield evaluation wafer now that contains over 200,000 transistors, basically shift registers. And it was put together for the purposes of determining what types of yields could be obtained from this basic wafer. In the normal manufacturing process, this wafer, after the basic diffusions and depositions and so forth, will be tested. Each of those little windows in there would be tested for its operation. Each of those windows might be a tenth of an inch, 12th, a 15th of an inch on the side. The ones that are good or bad would be marked. In some processes, they use a magnetic ink. And then most of the, about 95% of the industry will then dice that wafer up into little pieces of confetti. And the bad pieces are thrown away, and the good pieces are then mounted. The approach that we've taken on the particular program that I'm going to talk about attempts to use the entire wafer without dicing it up, without using extra processing steps in terms of extra layers of metal. May I have the next slide, please? This merely repeats graphically what I just said, verbally. As I say, most of the industry is taking the left route there, the superchip approach, you might call it, which is to dice the wafer up and package the perfect chips. The M²8 micromatrix approach is being pursued by Fairchild, for example. We're building one of the LSI computers we're building at Litton is a digital differential analyzer on a chip called the C1000. And your practically production realizable chips, say within the next year or two in production, would be around 1,000 transistors with this approach. Now, the other approach would be to take the entire wafer, as I stated in the previous slide, and use the entire wafer. Don't dice it up. This would, in theory, it would eliminate many of the manufacturing steps, namely those associated with the dicing of the wafer, and the handling, and then the individual bonding. There are two approaches that I'm aware of that are being taken to use the entire wafer. One of them is discretionary wiring, which is being used at Texas Instruments, and one of the speakers will talk on this. And the other is the approach that we're using at Litton. The realizable number of transistors, if you consider the wafer as an individual part, is obviously a lot higher. A figure of 10,000 transistors is reasonable to talk about. The reliability testing to date on integrated circuits, for instance, in the Minuteman Reliability Test Program, disclosed the rather surprising, at that time, surprising result that the failure rate of a semiconductor part seemed to be relatively independent of the number of individual active components within that part. For example, an integrated circuit containing 10 transistors or so on a single silicon substrate, a little 40 by 50 mil chip, had the same failure rate as had previously been determined for individual transistors. And many of you in the audience, of course, are aware of this, but this fact led to the thought that if more parts could be put on a single silicon substrate, that perhaps the failure rate of these superchips would be, if not quite as good as the relatively conventional integrated circuits, perhaps close to it. If you're now putting 1,000 transistors on a single substrate, whereas before you could only put 10, you're going to be able to build systems with a smaller number of parts, and parts translate into reliability. Of course, this hasn't been proven out by any extensive testing as yet. It was a hypothesis 4 years ago when the Air Force funded their programs, and it's still really just a hypothesis today. Well, carrying that hypothesis to its logical extension, If one can now use the entire wafer with the, I mentioned the 200,000 transistors that we have on a yield evaluation wafer that we're working with now, and if you can use these transistors effectively, you can build systems with a very small number of parts, and what previously took many thousands of integrated circuits now would take a small number of parts. Also, the using a wafer, again, you would hope that it would reduce the number of lead attachments that you would have to have because of the number of parts. Next slide, please. The problem with using the wafer, can we focus that a little bit? The problem with using the wafer is the problem of using this. Now we're getting into the unique requirement, one of the unique requirements of large-scale integration. It's using a device which has imperfections. Now, the traditional approach to making systems out of unreliable components, of course, has been redundancy. But what are you going to do when you have a device where the percentage of good parts to the total may be under 10%? You could say, well, all right, we'll take each part and make it redundant 10 times. That would mean that 10% of your system would be usable and the other 90% would not be usable. That would be what I would call more or less the traditional redundancy approach. Now, there's another type of redundancy possible. The functional modular approach has been conjectured for quite a few years now. It's the idea that if you have a number of cells, each able to take a portion of the problem and each able to work relatively independently of the other cells, that you can use such an array of cells in to the extent that the cells are good. In other words, if a cell is bad, you don't have to use it. With a system of this sort, if you have 100% yield, you can use all of the cells. If you have 10% yield, you're only able to use 10% of the wafer. This type of redundancy is what we based this computer on. Now, each of these cells, we want to minimize the number of leads entering and leaving because we do operate on a common bus system. So this is where the array processing comes into the act, parallel processing, array processing. The idea of breaking the problem up into a large number of smaller parts, such that each part it represents part of the total problem. Then you can assign each part of the problem to one of these cells in the array. And each of the cells can be like every other cell. Each cell can be relatively slow. They don't have to be fast because you've broken the problem up like that. Next slide, please. This is a simplified block diagram of the computer. As you can see, the arithmetic units are all bused together on a common bus. A steering device called the central control unit operates between the processing arithmetic units on the top and the memory modules on the bottom. Both the memory and the processing portions of the system are on wafers. The central control unit is a single element, and this is being done with chips. Next slide, please. That's a block diagram of the individual cell. You can see that each cell has a accumulator, a multiple CAN register. The address registers on the left side there are the means of obtaining information from the bus system. Each of the wafers is a roughly 1.5 inches square. It contains 36 of these arithmetic units. The original use of parallel processing, original concept of parallel processing, as is being currently developed under the ILLIAC 4 program, was to handle problems which by their very magnitude were too large for the conventional single processor machine to handle. In other words, you can make a processor more powerful by speeding up its clock rate and its going to carry acceleration and things of this sort. But you come up to the point where you just can't make the problem go any faster. So then you conceive of breaking it up into smaller parts. And this is, and then assigning each of the smaller parts to a relatively powerful arithmetic unit. The second reason for going to parallel or array processing is that certain problems, by their very nature, lend themselves to mechanization of this sort. For example, a traffic control problem, or a radar data processing problem, radar digital filters, a lens, radar lens pointing. It's easily broken up into a large number of small problems. It's conceivable that payroll calculations, for example, could also be done this way. So here an array processor looks quite natural. The third reason for going to array processing is the unique requirements that large-scale integration puts on the system. And that was the reason we went to it in this case, because we were able to put our computer on these large wafers. The initial application that we're developing it for the Air Force is for the guidance and control of an air-to-surface missile, which is certainly not an array problem by its very nature. Array processors do have certain limitations, especially when you try to apply it to a problem like that. We have several features in the computer that we feel help us to overcome these limitations. As I said when I started, the main problem that we're in now in the program is the problem of checking the logical design out, the rework cycles. We're using the Gerber plotter, just as NCR, to develop our artwork. We have planned to purchase, and we should have it in any month now, a new machine developed by OptiMechanisms Corporation, which will make our masks for us. Up to this time, we have been depending on a local mask-making firm, Electromask Corporation. But we're hoping that this OptiMechanisms machine will give us a faster turnaround time and come to the heart of the problem that seems to be characteristic of the checkout of large-scale integration. The computer is, we expect to have it in a brass board form approximately a little over a year from now. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. The third paper is entitled The LIMAC, an LSI Demonstration Vehicle. The author is G.B. Herzog of RCA Laboratories. Jerry comes from the state of Minneapolis, town of Minneapolis, rather, and received his B.S. and M.S. degrees from the University of Minnesota. He went to RCA very early in the game in 1951 and has remained there ever since, where he is director of the Data Processing and Applied Research Laboratory. Jerry?
I'd like to start off by acknowledging the Air Force support for this contract work, which Claire referred to earlier. The program did start in 1966. I do want to acknowledge the support and encouragement of the Air Force. However, as a taxpayer, I want to assure you that the Air Force ended up paying only about 20 or 25% of the total cost of this program, and I'm relieved to know that as a taxpayer. I also want to acknowledge that the work I'm reporting today is the work of many people within RCA, both in their components, systems, and research divisions. Now, one of the most important tasks in starting a research program of this type, of course, is to have a name for the program. And when it first started, somebody suggested to me, after looking at... Already? After looking at some of the papers that were being given on large-scale integration a few years ago, that the entire field of researchers should have an acronym, and they suggested that they should be known as Large Integrated Array Researchers, and that comes out L-I-A-R-S. Think about it. LIMAC is an acronym that stands for Large Integrated Monolithic Array Computer, and it's been an easy handle to use for our program, which was an effort to evaluate the problems of large-scale integration, fabrication, and application. It was a program structured in such a way that all aspects of making and using LSI would have to be faced. This is a report on that program some 3 years later. 4 boundary conditions were established as guidelines at the beginning of this program. 1, we wanted to build a demonstration vehicle in which LSI arrays would be operated and performance evaluated. The design of this demonstration vehicle would be based on that of a high-performance computer capable of performing as a general-purpose computer, but also with special capability in the solution of navigational-type problems. The resulting design and actual LSI arrays would then be like those needed for a task-oriented, high-purpose, but general-purpose, high-performance, but general-purpose computer. The systems architecture was to evaluate improvements in gate-to-pin ratios that might be obtained by approaching the partitioning of a computer in a new way, which would take advantage of the economy of LSI gates and minimize the number of pins needed coming into a package. As a result, we ended up with a rather flexible demonstration vehicle, and I want to emphasize that it is a demonstration vehicle and is not intended as a computer. A large part of the circuitry that went into it was to make it easy to exercise the various arrays in the machine. Second ground rule was that the type of logic chosen was to be such that future efforts could extend its performance, limited only by the state of the technology and not by the fundamentals of device operation. This led to the choice of non-saturating type logic, known as emitter-coupled ECL, or also known as current mode CML logic. This choice was made because saturated logic is always fundamentally limited by the saturation and storage effects in the devices, while emitter-coupled logic is limited only by the device parameters, which improve as the technology of pattern generation and process control improve. Unfortunately, emitter-coupled gates are the most difficult of all gates to produce because of the tight resistor ratios that must be maintained in manufacture. Third, we were to seek means for improving yields of LSI arrays. Application of standard statistics indicated extremely high yield of individual gates would be needed to get perfect arrays containing 100 or more circuits. Of course, we knew that conventional statistics did not really apply. They had to be modified because the same argument about you can't make ICs because the yield on individual transistors is so low had proven to be wrong. In fact, we can make ICs. At least some people can. The testing for good gates on an array and computer-generated interconnection patterns, which avoided bad gates on the array, certainly had intuitive appeal. We were tempted to go that direction. However, the difficulty and cost of implementing such a program plus the uncertainty of test data obtained by probing fine geometry devices, and again, we're looking forward to the time where we want to really make high-speed devices, caused us to reject this approach, which has subsequently come to be known as discretionary wiring. The decision to attempt process improvement to the point where LSI arrays of 100 high-performance gates could be fabricated with reasonable yield of perfect arrays was based on our previous experience with new process technology, plus this realization that standard statistics did really not apply to large arrays, just as they hadn't applied to the making of ICs. And Murphy, several years ago, pointed out the mathematical models that show why this is true. Fourth condition was that a semiconductor memory was to be included in this LSI investigation and should have fundamental advantages over a magnetic memory. Should have higher speed, higher operational reliability, less power dissipation. We chose to go with complementary MOS memory elements. This again posed a tougher technological challenge than alternatives, but promised a larger payoff with higher speed at much, much lower power, good system noise immunity, relaxed tolerances on power supplies, etc. Because there was a session this morning on semiconductor memories, and various types of semiconductor memories are now commercially available, I'm not going to discuss this aspect of the program. It was discussed this morning. Obviously, memories are the easiest to do in LSI and are the furthest along in terms of practical application. Now, let's look at some of the results of the program. This is the demonstration vehicle which I referred earlier. The actual computer resides in this small opening in the front panel. It's a computer or demonstration vehicle of some 5,000 gates. They're on large printed circuit boards, which you'll see later. The rest of the machine is the operator's console, which allows us to perform the functional tests I referred to. The rest of the cabinet, power supplies, some core memory, and some blowers to keep the arrays cool. Part of the system problem was to reduce the or improve the gate-to-pin ratio so that for arrays of 100 to 200 gates, we would not be limited by the number of pins coming into the package. The data on existing computers indicated that for partitionings on the order of 100 gates or 100 circuits, you'd require about 100 leads coming into the package. Certainly, there are special cases where the results are not as unfavorable, and also for special purpose computers and particularly serially organized computers, this ratio did not apply. But for general purpose machines, there was recognized need in the industry to improve the gate-to-pin ratio of the machine partitioning. Our efforts very early in the game, which were published in our first contract reports, indicated that the work we'd been doing on a distributed control of the machine could, in fact, improve the gate-to-pin ratios by a factor of 3 to 1 at the 100-gate level. The results of our program did, in fact, end up with arrays of 144 gates and 216 gates in packages with 60 and 90 leads, respectively. Not actually all of these leads are used. Where there were spare leads, they were paralleled and used for the power supply and ground connections. The partitioning gave us large platters with a much more favorable gate-to-pin ratio. Functional units required only 28 leads coming in and had some 450 gates per function. The construction of the machine for debugging of the logic employed conventional integrated circuit packages on a large plug-in board. and a large functional unit might be a section of this board, for example, with some 28 leads coming in. And these are dual and quad gates in these packages. They're standard off-the-shelf emitter-coupled logic gates. The parts of the machine that were put in array form are parts of these registers, and we sometimes refer to the machine organization as a register machine organization because it is structured to have the form of a lot of parallel registers which translate the control commands into the operation in the functional units. One section of a board containing 144 gates could be contained in a single package, which we'll see later. The typical emitter-coupled gate dissipates 120 milliwatts in its high-speed version. The equivalent gate in the array dissipated 10 milliwatts. Most of our cooling power was required for this preliminary form where we had the standard gates. The reduced power consumption in the array was, of course, due to the relaxed load of capacitive load on the gates and the higher impedances that could be used in the array environment. The same 4 to 5 nanosecond speed of the gate was maintained at the lower power dissipation. The circuit was constructed from individual components in a cell structure with resistors, transistors being available in the structure and metallized according to the type of function desired. Notice this is a standard emitter-coupled pair with a standard input configuration, devices being paralleled on one side of the differential pair. An alternate, and this is the form used to operate with the outside world where the signal levels are normal ECL swing. Inside the array, the cells were configured to operate with emitter followers on the inputs, which allows us to operate with a much higher load impedance and thereby minimizing power dissipation. Now, yield was an important consideration. As I indicated, this was one of the biggest technological factors to be worked on in the program, and everyone recognized that a large number of defects are introduced when the photomask is put in contact with the silicon wafer for exposure. It's very important to have perfect photomasks to start with. You put a lot of effort into making them perfect and then scratch them by putting them in contact with the silicon wafer, you've wasted a lot of effort and you have to start over. We used what we refer to as a close space printing technique where the mask never comes in contact with the silicon wafer. We have used collimated UV illumination here, which gives us adequate resolution for lines down to about 2/10 mil width. We feel this has been a very important factor in increasing the yields. It's made it possible to improve the photomask quality to the point where we consider the mask to be perfect, and they stay this way over a period of the manufacture of some 1,000 perfect arrays of a 72-cell structure. Another important consideration in eliminating defects in the array is in the masking technique during the diffusion process. Certain diffusions in making integrated circuits are a very long period of time, and any weakness in the oxide due to a weakness in the photoresist when you're etching and opening in the oxide due to specks of dust on the mask originally will cause diffusions in unwanted regions. To eliminate this, we used our solid-to-solid diffusion technique, which we had pioneered before entering this contract effort. In this technique, instead of opening up a clean oxide and diffusing through it with a gaseous source, we put a doped oxide on the surface of the silicon, take the oxide away, except in areas where we want diffusion, cover it with a clean oxide by deposition, and then drive in the impurity to the silicon to dope our desired areas. This is a big improvement. But for safety's sake, we use a belt and suspenders arrangement where we start with the thermal oxide, open the areas for diffusion as normal, fill it in with doped oxide, take the doped oxide away where it's not needed, which leaves us a structure with the doped oxide in the openings, a clean oxide over the top, and then do the drive-in diffusion. This has been a substantial contributor to the high yields obtained. The one further factor in getting high yields was the fact that nature, for once, tends to be working with us. Murphy pointed out in his papers a few years back that a standard Poisson distribution does not apply to defects in integrated circuits. The defects tend to come in clusters rather than randomly distribution, so you've got a good chance of getting some perfect arrays in areas such as this. Looks like this in terms of statistical curves. If you followed a standard Poisson distribution, you would say as the chip size goes up, you rapidly lose out on yield. The fact of the matter is a curve with alpha about equal to 3 is much more representative of the facts of life, and our data fit this curve, which says when you're working with large size arrays, you may gain as much as a factor of 4, 2 to 8% yield in what you can obtain in a factory operation. This shows a yield map of some arrays employing 72 gates. This is our best average yield. Coming down here in the cab this morning, I hadn't been in New York for quite a while, so I asked the driver after I got out at the hotel, what's the average tip? And he said $5, and I blanched a little bit, gave him the $5, and he said, thanks, you're the first guy that's ever come up to average. Actually, this is our best yield. Typical average yield is more like 20%. 72 gate arrays look something like this. It's first level of metallization. This chip is about 100 by 150 mils. And as I indicated, this is the size chip on which we're getting the 20% yield figure. And I hasten to add, this is not a factory type yield. This is under carefully controlled conditions. More of an R&D type environment. 144 gate arrays are packaged in this 60 lead package, as you see.